I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is the Unapologetically Black Podcast.
Understanding that your blackness is part of your greatness.
Blackness just comes from being me, and that's it.
Men are allowed to do whatever the fuck they want to do. They can be cheaters, they can be liars, but women are expected to be righteous.
So if you're someone who in a concert you're going to say the N-word, in my opinion, at home you're going to say it as well. In friendship, there's someone who deposits and there's someone who withdraws. You don't want to be the friend that's keep depositing and the person that keeps withdrawing.
Poor people don't have time for depression.
I'm so tired.
Banning abortions doesn't actually reduce abortion.
But actually, if my mental health is not okay, I can't help you in any capacity.
I mean, my entire life, I've lived under the gaze of my parents.
Fuck that shit.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Unapologetically Black Podcast. Roshan and I are back. We're back at work. We're very upset about it. Well, you're not back at work yet.
No, I start a new job tomorrow. Yay!
Yay!
And I feel like, I'm not going to lie, I've started to feel like a bit of a bum because I've been off for like 6 weeks and I'm like, what do I do with myself? This entire week, I did nothing. Didn't even leave my house. Other than once to go gym, and that was it.
Sometimes rest is good, though. Like, I started back last week, and I definitely don't feel like I've gotten back into the groove of things. You know, when you're off for a really long time, and then It's like, how do I do my job? That's how I feel. That's how I've been feeling all of this week. But I think it's because I've genuinely never taken this long of a holiday off of work. Like, I don't think I've ever taken longer than a week and a half off of a job.
And not to actually switch off. You would still do work.
Exactly. Like, we switched off of everything. We switched off of the podcast. We switched off of the platform. We switched off of our 9-to-5s. It was really good, actually. I'm increasingly thinking about becoming a housewife.
No, for real. And guys, if this is your first time listening to the episode, let me just fill you in, yeah? Leanne lives in Jamaica part-time. And I went to Jamaica in December to celebrate Leanne getting married to her man.
I was going to pick up my hands and show my ring, but I'm not wearing it yet.
It's not that. But basically, so we could actually switch off, so Leanne could actually enjoy her wedding, because Leanne likes to work when she shouldn't be working, I was like, let's batch record some of these episodes. So I actually haven't spoken to Leanne about the wedding since the wedding. So I want to do it with you guys on the pod, so you're a part of the conversation. Obviously, I've seen Leanne because I was in Jamaica with her. Obviously, I experienced what I would call the most beautiful wedding ever. If my man needs to plan a wedding for me,
aww,
he needs to talk to Leanne's team, yeah? Because that wedding was, like, perfect. But that's my opinion. For you, Lee, how do you feel about the wedding?
Shout out to I Do Islands because they were my wedding planners and they were amazing. Shout out to Sharon Sentee who did my decor and really like listened to every single thing that I said and sometimes gave me advice as to what works and what didn't work. I had a great time. You know, it's so funny. People always say how people turn into bridezillas and how wet, stressful weddings are. And it was definitely stressful leading up to it, largely because Barry was really annoying throughout the process of planning. But on the day, it was honestly the most stress-free day I've had in a very long time in terms of events. Like getting ready was stress-free. getting there was stress-free. The only thing that stressed me out a little bit, which, as I'm sure you've realized having been in Jamaica for an entire month, is that everybody ran late. Like, I was there on time and people were still arriving to the church. So I was like sitting on the side of the road in the car waiting on the church to fill up before I started, before I got out of the car to start, you know, the processional.
I didn't notice that.
I think we started like 15 minutes late, but we caught back up on time because my wedding planner is amazing. And everything that I wanted in terms of how low key it felt. I mean, Roshan will tell you, I was praying that it didn't rain, and it didn't rain for the entire day until as soon as the speeches were over and dinner was finished, it started raining and people just danced in the rain.
That was a testament to how beautiful your wedding day was and how like much people adore yourself and Barry. I was like, you know, weddings are expensive. Everyone better be dancing. Forget the rain. Everyone better be dancing. And the music was amazing. Like, the music was sensational from start to finish. And something that really stood out for me as well, amongst like, I mean, everything stood out. The whole wedding was a standout. But the hosts were fantastic.
Really? You like them?
When you go to a wedding or like a funeral or like a 60th, those sort of like grand events, the hosts talk at you for ages and you're bored and you're just like, we want to eat, we want to dance, we want to party. Or like the speeches are just long. And it's like, we want to celebrate this person, but also wrap it up. It's not even funny. Do you get what I mean? Whereas I feel like everyone's speech, other than maybe one, but anyway, everyone's speech was just like punchy, good. And I don't mean punchy as in rushed. I mean
it had moments.
It was like everyone was a public speaker, you know? And the host, there was a journey, like, they'll talk about you in school and then your school friend would come up. But it was done in a really like just authentic and like smooth way. Like everyone where I was sitting was praising them. Like I thought it was amazing. Good.
I'm glad. And again, like we didn't know, right, how it landed with everybody. But essentially what we did was I told everybody that their speech could not be longer than 3 minutes. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the hosts, we met with them before, but they know us really well. I would say those are the two people that know us best as a couple rather than just individuals. And so that's why we chose them. And then we gave them like pointers and basically I gave them ideas as to how they could make it interactive. But I didn't know what they were going to do and what they weren't going to use. So I'm glad it worked out well. Yeah, it was just a good day, man. Just like good vibes, good energy. I feel like there were just the right amount of people there. It wasn't overly crowded. I didn't eat anything. That's the only thing that pisses me off is that I didn't get
Why?
To eat because we were too busy when everybody was like eating dinner. So we didn't make it for the cocktail hour because we were taking pictures.
Yeah. And oh my gosh. You see, listen. Oh, you see the old doves? Yeah.
I'm so
the canapés. They were amazing.
Oh.
They were, no, listen to me. It was better than the mains. When they were coming out, and you know, I don't eat meat,
But
I always feel like I'm really limited normally when I go to like functions or events. Myself and Aaliyah, who I went with, also doesn't eat meat. When we saw those, I don't even remember, Callaloo, it was just fantastic. I went to the man and I said, let me just take a few because I've seen you come out, so everyone must have eaten it. Let me take a few. They were so nice.
Oh my goodness, I'm so mad we didn't get to eat them.
And the view, Leanne.
So the view, the place that we got married is my girlfriend's back garden. And
please upsell, please. It's not normal.
The name, the house has a name, which I think is an indication of the size. And it's called Awesome View Manor. And the view is awesome. Like, it's funny because she had her 40th birthday later on New Year's Eve. So I went back up there for New Year's Eve and she had fireworks and it was just like, I was just like, oh, that would have been cool to have fireworks at the wedding. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you can pretty much see most of Kingston and it's at night. One of the main things that I did was I said, I want to get married at a time. So by the time people are coming for the reception, they'll get to see the sunset. And I guess you guys did see the sunset, right?
The end. You know I love a view, okay? When we arrived, I was having the canapés and drinks and it was just, do you know what it felt like? And maybe I think you're not even deep in it, especially because we're British coming over, yeah? Mm. It felt like when you watch the American movies and they have those big family gatherings and you've got the people serving food, you've got the music, you've got the view. I felt like I was experiencing that in real life.
Aww.
It was actually the most surreal feeling ever. Like, we was all just so gassed, like, wow. You would have thought we had never been out before. Like, we've been in prison for 12 years. I was like, this is fantastic.
Let me also say that while I was busy prepping for the wedding, Roshan did road. Like, you went to every single club, every single beach, every single party, every single bar. You went to places that I had never even heard of.
No, for real. But guys, it's for content, okay? So check out our TikTok, okay? Because when this comes out, we'll now be starting to post the Jamaica content. It's to help you guys and obviously live life, because we had to switch off, because, you know, 2023, it was
a lot.
It was a challenge. It was a mental challenge. But you know what? Something that I think, yeah, that Jamaica helped me to actually deep is that there's power and there's almost, well, let me ask you actually, do you think, or do you consider it a privilege, the fact that you're able to talk about your mental health openly with people, whether it's one person or several people, do you see that as like a privilege?
Yeah, 100%, because this is definitely not a normal conversation here. It's way more advanced of a conversation in the UK, and we know how limited of a conversation this is in general in the UK. Here, the conversations about mental health are really just emerging. Like, the fact that I have so many people in my life that go to therapy or think therapy is important is really just a reflection of how much I talk about therapy, not necessarily how much it is talked about widely.
Because there was a time it was in Jamaica, yeah, and we went, this was the first time we met up with you, like outside of our apartment, and I left the table twice, yeah.
Yeah.
It was because it was really triggering me.
Really?
So I left and I was like, I seem to like just find myself a corner. And I could feel myself about to have a panic attack. So I was like, let me go outside, just calm myself down and breathe. And then when I came back, the other Leanne was like, are you okay? Listen. I am not that person you can say, are you okay to? And I'm going to be like, yeah.
Yeah.
So she said it and I was like, yeah, I'm fine. And she asked me again, are you sure? And I'm like, listen, if you can tell I'm not okay and I'm telling you yes, don't ask me again.
Yeah.
At that point, I then left again because I'm like, now I'm going to cry. And it actually isn't about me.
Oh, I didn't know.
I'm actually enjoying my time here, but now you're making me sadder than what I've just, you know, recouped. So then I left, and then Leanne came outside of me, like she followed me outside.
I remember.
After, and she was like, what's wrong? She was like, Aaliyah said that it's probably the music that's triggering you. And I was like, yeah, it is, but like, I'm fine, but the music is also directly triggering me, sort of thing. And like, I used that day and that moment as a testament to how much I was able to enjoy the rest of the holiday, because I realized that being able to speak openly and frank about my emotions allowed me to like embrace the triggers more throughout the rest of my experience in Jamaica, which as a whole was very triggering without me even realizing. Do you get what I mean? And it made me deep, like the privilege of being able to talk about mental health, being able to talk about grief, being able to talk about like anxiety and these sort of things, because some people would be in those circumstances or situations and not feel comfortable to talk to people about the fact that I had to run out because I was going to have a panic attack.
I would never even think to express that out loud. I would probably have just left.
For the whole place?
Yeah. And just been like, see you later, guys.
Really?
Yeah. Well, actually, just as an aside, and you don't have to include this in the episode, but was it the loudness of the music that was triggering or the actual songs that were triggering to you?
The song. Okay. It reminds me of not just my aunt, but it reminds me of like there was a particular song that was like her song. Do you get what I mean?
Okay,
and it played. And I was like, give me a chance to just, this is like day two. Gosh.
And it's also nice actually that Aaliyah, as one of your best friends, knew without you saying that that was what was probably the issue.
Yeah. But yeah, I thought it would actually be quite nice to just explore that with you. But before we get into that, do you have a fact for us today?
Well, I was going to say, I have a fact that is interestingly enough tied into the privilege of being able to explore and talk about mental health. So, you know, we talk about, you know, our civil rights leaders and, you know, how, and I think we don't necessarily talk about what they must have been through and the impact that it must have had on their mental health, whether we're talking about Winnie Mandela, Marcus Garvey, Martin Luther King. And so I was looking a little bit at some facts about various civil rights leaders. And interestingly enough, Martin Luther King had multiple periods of severe depression. And actually, even as young as, you know, being an adolescent, he tried to commit suicide twice.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Which I would have, I would have had no clue. Like, as I said, it didn't even dawn on me, or I didn't even think about, we think about their work so much. Yeah. And actually, near the end of his life, many people tried to get him to seek like professional psychiatric care, but he refused to. And I'm assuming, this is an assumption, that one of the reasons that he probably refused to seek care, but was because he actually did not want to deal with it, because he thought, one, his work wasn't too important, and he didn't want to be perceived as weak or incapable of leading this civil rights movement. So it's interesting how, like, I wonder today if Barack Obama, for instance, said, you know, I'm struggling with depression, would it have made him seem like less of a good president? You know, if we're talking about us as even as platform leaders, like the fact that we talk about mental health is something that is seen as a positive thing now, which I think is a huge shift from 10, 15 years ago even.
But you see the idea of like weakness. You said that like he may have felt weak in that moment, or been judged as someone who is weak in that moment. Is that sort of the same reason why if you were in my situation in Jamaica, you would have left?
Probably, because let me take it a step back. It would be dependent on who I was with. Right. So part of me would probably leave because I didn't want to burden anybody else with my emotions or how I was feeling. And so I would just remove myself from the situation and think that nobody would actually miss me. The other part of that is that I wouldn't necessarily, if I was with a different set of people that are stereotypically Jamaican, let me put it that way, and don't talk about their mental health or their emotions, I probably wouldn't, because they would laugh at me and be like, what's wrong with you?
Is that how bad it is over there?
Yeah. 100%. I mean, I was having a conversation with a partner one day, it's not recently, and we were talking about mental health, and I was talking to them about the various issues that they may have as to why they are the way they are and why they deal with their tempo in a certain way or why they have a certain attitude. And he was like, I'm an asshole. I don't have a backstory. Like, there's no, this is just who I am.
Can I just say as well, I just said, is that how they are over there? But actually, that's actually how people are here.
Yeah, 100%.
It's actually a community issue. Because actually, when I'm saying that, and I'm like, no, Shan, there's guys that you meet, or there's relatives that you know, and you can't have these same conversations with and you know, explore certain topics with them. Do you get what I mean? They're so, like, shut off from their emotions that they don't even know what it means to tap into that level of I don't even like weakness. Let me say vulnerability. They don't even know how it feels to tap into that.
I think it's a generational thing more specifically. I was talking to my godmother the other day, and I was talking to her about therapy. And she was just like, you think the answer for everything is therapy, 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 therapy. Why you don't just go to church? God is my therapist. I was like, Auntie, trust me. I was like, I'm not saying it's for everybody, but it works for me. And that's what that matters. No, I was going to say, I also think there's this idea that when we talk about our mental health is not in a good place, we're actually talking about people being crazy. And there's a distinction between mental health and poor mental health. There is a distinction between mental illness, which again is not something that we label people as crazy either.
I think that point rings true to why so many people, not, I wasn't saying men in particular, but it's not just men, are afraid or don't like tapping into the conversation around their own mental health. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you said, as we know, mental health is a spectrum, right? So not everyone's going to have ill mental health, poor mental health or whatever, but ultimately it's still a spectrum. And I feel like I definitely grew up in an environment, not like necessarily in my, in fact, definitely not within my household, but like just growing up where I did in South London, there was that like known or prolific crazy person. Yeah. And I think let me not even say his name because he's actually a G and he's still alive. But let's say his name was Ashley. It would be like, oh, have you seen crazy Ashley and his dancing in Croydon today? And I feel like a lot of places, they all have that crazy person and they're just labeled to be crazy. But actually, they may just be homeless and they like to dance. They might struggle with alcoholism because of whatever reason. But it's like, because of the way that the tone and the way people say, like, that person's crazy or that person's mad or that person's this. And like the way the place it's coming from is always with such like negative vim. I think that's why people then don't like being like, oh, I'm experiencing this or I'm going through that, because subconsciously they then are matching themselves with that crazy person from their area.
Exactly, exactly. And it's funny because when I was looking up stats around this, it says 63% of people within the Black community view mental health as a sign of personal weakness, which means that only 16% of Black people are reporting mental illness because there's that stigma attached to it. So think about all of the people who are suffering in silence because they just don't want to be seen as weak, or they don't want to be seen as less than or abnormal or weird or whatever other terminologies we want to add to it.
I remember ages ago, yeah. I mean, I still have the interest, but like ages ago, I was reading into like the criminal justice system and reoffenders, yeah, of like violent crimes. And I remember I was looking at like gang culture and I watched this documentary. I can't remember what it was called or the specific stat, but what they were basically saying is a lot of people that are in gangs and like reoffend, they have experienced the crime to themselves first at a young age. They then have complex PTSD. They don't know that because they don't have the language or the tools to navigate it or to speak about it, and they then reoffend. And actually, a lot of these people that are reoffending from a place of actually needing help and support, but their environment doesn't constitute to allow them to even be aware of that in the first place.
Yeah.
And it made me think, wow.
Exactly.
All these people are criminals. Yeah, they are. But actually, if there was more work done to break down the stigmas, to open like positive conversations about mental health, they may not have got to that place. And obviously, there's other factors, like the fact that they were a victim of this, it might be linking to like poor economic social backgrounds and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But like, I just think it's crazy.
And I think we think about, especially when you're talking about people who commit crimes, right? We think about people who commit crimes in isolation. Like, we're like, oh, this person robbed a bank. They must be a horrible person. But actually, that person might have robbed a bank because they were starving and needed support. And had felt like they had no other options because they couldn't get a job and their mental health was starting to be impacted and they needed to feed a family. Do you know what I mean? There are so many contextual factors that lead people to committing crime that I think we can't just look at people and label them as criminals. No, we are all human beings who, let's keep it real, at some point in time, have you ever committed a crime? Like something that you could be arrested for? Exactly. And I would like to think that you are not a bad person. You're not in the business of harming anybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure I've done things that I could be arrested. I have done things that I could be arrested for. And as you said, if we started talking about and normalizing this conversation around mental health from a very, very young age, you know, we've been talking about, and mental health covers for everything from bipolar disorder to anxiety to depression to Asperger's. Literally, there's so many different things. Some are more severe than others, and you know, a lot of them can be managed, just like how we manage our physical health at any given point in time.
And that's what's weird. Not weird, let me not say weird, but that's what I think is interesting to me. Is that when we talk about this idea of like mental health, it's like this, to some people it's very foreign. It's very like, it's the Black word. We don't say that, yeah. But if you talk about physical health, starting the new year and going to the gym, yeah, let's get gains with the guys. Yeah, everyone's, that language is fine. Like if you break your leg, let me get crutches. You don't mind being seen with the crutches, but like your mental health is always going to be with you, bro. So it's like, we also need to pay a lot of attention to that. But I wanted to ask you, yeah, when did you first have an awareness of your own mental health, or like mental health as a subject to talk about it?
From a very young age, actually. And it's interesting because I feel like when I did bring it up to my family, I remember when my parents had started to kind of separate and there was lots of like turmoil in our family, without even asking anybody for advice, I sought out a therapist. So I knew like some of my friends' really? Parents were psychologists. And so I called a friend and went to go and see their mom, and I actually tried to get our entire family to go. Some were more willing than others. And yeah, so maybe when I was, I want to say like 14, 15 was probably the first time that I went to a therapist, because I felt like I needed support for what I was going through at the time.
But to even have that awareness of therapy, of a therapist, where did that come from? Was it because of your friend's parents' jobs? So was it being friends with that friend that then allowed you to understand that? Because outside of that, how would you have known? I feel like that's quite a wise thing to be at 14. Like, let me go and get a therapist.
I don't know, actually. And my parents were not pro-therapy, right? It's not like they thought that I should see somebody, or they never pushed my brother or sister to go and see somebody. I don't think my brother and my sister has been to therapy, but only because I pushed her. But I don't think my brother has. And if he has, he hasn't said it to us. But yeah, I don't know, actually. I genuinely think it's because I had an awareness that I had friends who had parents who were psychologists. And I didn't even think of it as therapy at the time. Like, at the time, I remember the first person I ever saw was a psychiatrist, because my understanding of mental health was that, like, there is something wrong with me. I might need medication. And so let me go and see somebody, like a professional medical doctor who can prescribe me medication. And then it's in doing that as I found out about psychologists and different types of therapy and that kind of thing.
Because I remember my own, I was doing photography for my mum's workplace, and it was a workplace that was in the medical background, let's say. And a lot of their, not clients, what would you say? Like the patients,
right?
The patients. But people that are on the mental health spectrum, and you'd probably call them someone who has ill mental health.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, to the extent that I was doing photography to like promote this venue, but when I'm like, I had to be conscious of like, when I'm pointing the camera, don't point it towards this person, because they might start responding to that in a particular way and things like that. So I feel like that environment then fast tracked my whole experience and understanding of mental health, because I was having to understand all these people's individual needs, but at the same time I was interacting with them. So I was seeing that these people that on the street may have felt like a threat to me actually are really nice, are really warm, are like just normal people. But when you're younger, the people on the street that you call or you consider to be quote unquote crazy, they feel like anything but normal. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%. And it's something that I see a lot of uptown Jamaicans do when they see someone like wiping windows on the street or asking for money. I remember seeing a post one day, and it was just like, oh, these vermin, they just, you know, they need to be removed. And I'm just like, you're talking about them as if they're animals that should be exterminated. Like, these are people who had homes, who had families, and they didn't have the money or the support or the finances that you had to not let their health, their mental health deteriorate. And there are actually wealthy uptown families that just disown members of their family who have severe mental health, instead of just sending them to therapy or sending them to a psychologist or getting the support that they need to make themselves have completely manageable lives. Some of the people that we see on the street are people who have been ignored and their mental health has been neglected. And I think that's the sad part about it, is that a lot of what we see is preventable. It's interesting because I think we talked about this taboo in the Black community, and we know that white people have a tendency to see therapists way more. I think in the US, it's 33% of Black Americans with mental illness have sought help, whereas 50% of white Americans have sought help. I mean, we talk about therapy all the time, right? And for me, I know when I started to go to therapy, I only started to go to therapy when I had a problem. And now I feel like I have regular check-ins. And this is something Barry and I had a meeting, a very formal business meeting at the beginning of the year, to talk about our goals for 2024 as a couple. And one of our goals as a couple is to go to therapy on a bi-monthly basis. So every other month we'll have a session as a couple, and every month we'll go to sessions with our individual therapists. And you know, I saw this post from Kerry Washington where she was just like I go to the doctor for my routine medical checkups, I go to therapy. And so is that the way you treat therapy now, or have you found that there are other things that you do in order to maintain your mental health?
I think that's a really interesting question, because I think as much as I'm an advocate for therapy, if it works for an individual, I don't think it works for everyone. Mm-hmm. Or the talking therapy, which is how I'm talking about when I talk about therapy. I don't think that necessarily is everyone's access to therapy that works for them. But when I first went, it was because I went through an experience, and my best friend at the time was like, Shan, you've been through this before. You've never got help. Do you not think you should go to speak to a therapist about this? Mm. And I just thought, yeah, you're right. And so I did. And when I went, I was shook. And at that time, I was already someone who, like, was I a mental health first aider at that time? I don't know, but I'd already done a lot of work with mental health. Okay. I'd already spoken about it publicly quite a lot. But the idea of going, like, of me saying I'm actually going to go to therapy and do the work was scary. Mm-hmm. And I remember I went to this place and I sat down in this room, and there was like a Filipino lady opposite me, and she was asking me all these questions. And at the end, she explained that she might not necessarily be my therapist. She was just making my notes, and then I'll get put into the waiting thing, and then I'll. And I remember being really, really attached to her and being like, I have to have this lady as my therapist. Like, I can't have anybody else. And in the end, it wasn't her. I got somebody else. And the other person that I got was like amazing. Like, she really, really, really supported me. I don't know if I ever told you, she actually bought our Dope Black Woman cards.
No.
But yeah, anyway, the point is, because my entry point to therapy was for a very specific trauma-related thing, it then didn't mean that I had to continue therapy, because once I had done the work, once I had, let's say, recovered, once I was fine to maneuver life by myself without a therapist, that was just the end. Mm. And then the second time I got therapy after that was for a childhood trauma situation. And I only got it because I was like, I saw how much of an impact and how life-changing the first round of therapy was, that I was like, I've got to do this again for the childhood trauma. And that was linked to my anxiety. And I was even saying to my friend the other day, I was like, I've always said I'm someone that has anxiety, or that I operate from anxiety, but like, my life is so different now that, not to say I don't have anxiety or I don't consider myself someone that has it, but like, anxiety isn't me anymore. I feel like before I was one with anxiety, whereas now it's like I'm someone who experiences anxiety, but when I do experience it, it's very intense, and it's like mad. It's not in terms of like the levels compared to someone who doesn't really have it but has genuine anxiety. Anyway, I say all of that preamble to say is that I, because of the way I've accessed therapy has to do with extreme trauma, I then just have the tools to continue life. So I won't necessarily feel like I have to go to therapy all the time, because I've only gone for like trauma-based stuff. So you're meant to only go for a certain amount of time until you've healed from it, till you've got over that thing.
Right.
And then you just have the tools to continue.
Therapy is really expensive, or it can be really expensive. It's hard to find resources, and I'm sure we'll post or we'll kind of include resources in case anybody is interested in going to therapy. And if you want to DM us, you can DM us, and we have specific Black female therapists that we work with for anybody who is interested. But it can be really expensive. And so I think it's really important for us to talk about ways in which you can maintain mental health generally. So we just talked about going to the gym, right? And even though I haven't been since before the wedding, it's been about 5 weeks now, I've found that the gym really does help with maintaining just like a standard mental health. Like, being physical and not being sedentary makes a difference in terms of my mental health. Some people like to journal. I should probably do more of that. And just things like, you know, my stepson has been here for the past, he got here in kind of end of November. And we make it a point to have dinner together, which is something for me that's really important, because it breeds a little bit of like camaraderie and fellowship and communication around things that we probably wouldn't talk about because we're all so busy in our day-to-day lives. Barry and I know someone gave us a couple's prayer book. And so we do that together every night. We have a reading date. You know, I think those are things that keep me emotionally balanced. And so I'm curious, mm-hmm. because you've only accessed therapy through for reasons that are related to deep-seated trauma, what are like your day-to-day activities of maintaining just a solid balance of your mental health?
Mm-hmm. Well, what you just said feeds into the way that I do it, which I can't remember if I've mentioned on the podcast already before. But my last therapist, what he told me to do, or an exercise that I learned through working with him, was he made me write down a list of all the things that fill me up, that make me feel good. So my list might be listening to music. It might be watching a documentary. It might be being in nature. It might be talking to my mom, spending time with my family, going to the gym. That might be some of the stuff on my list, or it is some of the stuff on my list, yeah? So basically, whenever I start to feel low, I start to feel flat, I just go back to that list. Mm. And most of the time when I'm feeling low, it's because I haven't done some of the things on that list. So I think for me, as a cheaper way, I guess, to not going back to therapy, I just make sure that I'm treating myself kindly by adhering to the things that I know that fill me up. Like, I feel like a lot of people listening and just people in general, sometimes we feel low and you're like, I feel sad or I feel low and there's nothing actually triggering this. I don't know what's actually into this emotion. The reason why is because you're not doing the things on the list. So if your list is like, even down to like what we eat, yeah, I know I feel better just eating clean. So I think that's something that people can probably take to do. But also, you know how we mentioned therapy being expensive? Both times I done therapy, it was free. And I'm obviously based in the UK, so this might not apply to everyone. But sometimes there'll be charities, and this may only apply if it's trauma related, but sometimes there may be charities that pay for your mm-hmm. therapy or provide therapy sessions if you hit a certain criteria. That's one way. And also the NHS have a very long waiting list, and that's another way.
I'm sure we can find resources and include them that are across the board. And I think also, you know, we think about therapists in the form of psychologists or counselors, but our priests and our pastors can also be a really good source of having someone to talk to and walking us through. If, you know, if faith is where you're aligned, go and talk to your therapist, go and talk to someone that you have respect for in your religious community. Find a friend whose mom is a therapist and talk to them. We have some really great resources that we'll include. But yeah, just to say that not every time you need to seek counsel does it need to be a therapist or a medical professional like a psychiatrist. Sometimes you can go to your pastor. Sometimes you can go to your high school counselor. There might be a local community center that offers support in certain ways. So just look into it.
What would you say to someone who's like maybe listening and they're like, everyone talks about therapy, but it's scary for me. What would you say is like an entry point? Because something that I was thinking about when we was talking just now is that like, if someone was like that and listening, I'd probably tell them to keep a journal of like all their thoughts and feelings so that if they decided they wanted to go to therapy, they then got all that resources to like to give to them to fall back on.
That's a good idea. You know what I mean? That's a good idea. For me, you know what, and this is maybe a little bit of a tough love approach, and it what sparked this thought was you talking about the binge eating. Like, I love ice cream, right? And if I binge eat, that's it. When I want something to make me feel better, I go for chocolate or I go for ice cream. But it's not good for you. Mm-hmm. Everything in life is hard. Nothing that is worthwhile is easy. And I saw somebody else say this too, but it's like, you just have to choose your hard. Are you going to choose the hard of struggling with eating and overeating and the consequences of that? Or are you going to struggle with the hard of really tackling the work, which ultimately will provide a greater benefit? So
choose the hard, baby.
Choose your hard. It's just it's that true. Simple. Yeah. And just in terms of preparing to go to therapy, it's like, what's the worst that could happen? Give it a try. If you don't like it, don't do it and find something else.
I remember talking to a male figure that I have in my life, and I was talking to them about going to therapy because I realized that them not getting support on certain areas of their life is impacting their relationship. or ships with people in their life. And I said, look, you're going to lose a lot of people in your life because of the way you now maneuver as a result of not getting help from particular events. And they were like, if I go to therapy, I'm scared. And I said, that's fine. What are you scared of? And they said, I'm scared that I'm going to have to dig deep. And there's things that I purposely blocked out and I don't want to go back there. And even as someone who has done that, and even as someone who knows the benefits of doing that, shout out EMDR therapy, I didn't really know how to respond. And this was a while ago, so I definitely did respond. But in my head, I was like, fair enough. Like, like, I get it, because it's hard.
It is.
But it's like, what would you have said to someone in that situation? Because I feel like that's what a lot of people's, for people that aren't just like, therapy, mental health, I don't, you know, there's a spectrum, yeah? Some people who are anti-therapy are very much like, I've tried it and it's not for me, cool. Some people are like, I'm not telling no stranger my business. Yeah?
Yeah.
Some people are like, therapists don't care about me. Why do they care about me? They don't care about me. I just talk to my mama and my mama tells me. Yeah? And then there's people like us who actively go to therapy. And then there's people that are like somewhere in between all of that. And they're like, you know, therapy is something I want to try, but I'm terrified, bro. I'm scared. Like, what can we tell them?
This is a hard one because I think it's not down to us. So one of the things that I've learned, particularly as it relates to encouraging other people about therapy, is that pushing people often makes it worse. Like the more you tell someone that they have to do something or that they should do something, and you can provide all the reasons in the world as to why someone should go, and they still won't go. They just have to be ready. And that's just the truth of it. There's nothing that I can say to someone who's scared other than saying, this has worked for me and this is my experience, and sharing that experience authentically, that's going to make a difference. And sharing that experience authentically is also sharing the difficult parts of it. So it might actually be a deterrent. They have to be ready. It's like talking to someone who's been through any sort of trauma. Like they won't be ready to deal with it until they're ready, or until they get to a point where they realize that it's actually debilitating them and they have no other recourse.
So that goes back to my point, I guess, that I was saying about there's different types of therapy, isn't it? Because like for me, I like to chat, which is why I'm on the pod. Yeah. So talking therapy for me, and I'm also someone who's naturally quite emotive. So yeah. Talking therapy for me worked for me. Like, even though I found it really hard, it really benefited me. But I remember my first therapist saying that like, you can do dance therapy, you can do art therapy.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Art therapy. So I think maybe, because I completely do it, I completely agree with your point. And I've actually been there where I wouldn't say I encouraged someone to do therapy, but someone was supporting me in therapy and then thought, oh, let me try it out. And then in trying out, they got re-triggered and they were like, they just shut down, basically. Not from the world, but just from the idea of therapy. And I remember at that time thinking, gosh, I wish I didn't tell them that I was doing therapy now, because it encouraged them to do it and they've been re-triggered. But I actually think that person was having a bad therapist as opposed to like therapy being bad for them. So I definitely do think it's a personal thing. You're right.
Yeah. But the idea that you just proposed is actually a really good one. There are so many different types of therapy. And it's just about finding the one that fits for you, right? But I do think at some point in time, particularly if you're really struggling with a particular issue, or if you recognize that there are things that are just not shifting for you in terms of how you're feeling, that sometimes you do need a professional to direct you. So a professional therapist could actually say, I want you to try dance therapy, because they recognize that you have an innate connection with dance and with movement. It could be that you need a combination of all things. Like you need the physical movement, but you also need a way of expressing yourself. I think just try everything and see what fits.
What do you think for you was the hard part of therapy?
Oh God.
I've actually never asked you that. And I think, again, as someone who's very pro-therapy, therapy is fucking hard.
Really fucking
therapy
hard.
It's hard.
It's not easy. The hardest thing for me about therapy is owning up to my own shit. It's really easy to walk into a therapist's room and complain about all of the things that have been done to you without taking stock of how you got yourself there. Yeah. And it's still something I struggle with. Like Barry always says, oh, you don't like to be criticized. And I don't like it.
He said, your therapist told me, baby, that you don't like to be criticized.
I don't like to be criticized. So the way in which I need to be criticized has to come from a space of love and kindness and a willingness to make me a better person. It can't just be, you know, violent or aggressive or too blunt or straightforward. So yeah, being accountable is something that I have consistently struggled with, but something that I'm now learning to start with. Like I start with, before I start with, oh, poor me, look at what has happened. I start with, where did I go wrong? And what could I have done to make the situation better? Did I talk to this person in a way that was off key that, you know, then engendered? And letting things roll off my back as a result. It's so much easier to let go and forgive when you can put yourself in the space of accountability. Mm. What about you? What's the hardest part?
The hardest part of doing therapy for me, I think, so one of the things that was really hard, which I think a lot of people can probably relate to, is actually when you finish therapy. So sometimes, no matter how good your therapist is, no matter what they do at the end of the session to kind of get you back to what I would call the real world when you're out of your therapist's like head, having to continue your day when you've just had a really tough therapy session is wild.
Yeah,
very it's true. Really, really wild. Like I would finish sessions and then just feel like everything's been sucked out of me, and I don't want to scare people that are listening.
No, but it's emotionally draining.
It's emotionally draining. And I was doing therapy about like really, really traumatic things. And then part of my EMDR therapy meant that I was being taken back there. So it was like I was being taken back to a really traumatic environment and then having to continue my day and do a work meeting. Like that was really, really hard. So I think for me, what I then found beneficial was actually positioning my therapy sessions on a day where I know I haven't really got much to do afterwards. Or positioning my therapy sessions where I know that after the therapy session, I can have an hour to myself.
Yeah.
And just being really hyper aware about the environments that I'm doing it. So am I doing therapy sessions in a house that already triggers me, which it was at one point. So it was just an interesting journey. So I think, yeah, for me, that was one of the hardest things. But I think another hard thing about therapy, when you go to therapy and you learn the tools, when you learn the stuff, yeah. Like, you know how you mentioned a moment ago, like Barry said to you, oh, you don't like criticism, yeah. It's actually being in the moment of being criticized and then being like, oh, I'm acting like this because I don't like criticism. Like, sometimes the awareness is the hard bit.
Yeah.
Do you get what I mean? Like, 100%. Sometimes I find myself, or this week, I remember I was going to make a decision about something and I was like, I'm making a decision about something which I know is going to lead to self-sabotage. I do self-sabotage because X. Like, that awareness sometimes is actually really, really hard because, I don't know, I don't want to compare it to self-harm, but it feels like that for me sometimes. When I'm doing something that I know I've actually done, I'm actually already aware, I'm educated enough to know I shouldn't be doing this, and then I'm doing it. I'm like, that is hard because I'm like, I need to stop. And I kind of feel like there's like a new me and there's an old me, and the magnet is just constantly being pushed and pulled, pushed and pulled. And that experience in itself is really difficult. And but I think it's also part of the process.
Yeah, and it goes back to that choose your heart thing, right? Like, being that self-aware is hard, but so is doing the thing that you always did, right? Actually, I was very proud of myself last night. We were having a conversation and Barry said something to me and I just said, okay, honey. Because I knew he was right and I didn't want to argue. I didn't want to justify. I just said, okay. And I'm taking this on board and I'm going to deal with it. That's it. And I will. But it could have been so easy for me to be like, but, or this is why. And I was just like, no, no justifications, no explanations. This is it. He's correct. Let me just roll with it and act accordingly. So yeah, choose your heart, boo.
But can I just say, guys, with choosing the hard, yeah, if therapy is for you, it will change your life. Because I was living in the trenches. Yeah, I was imagine a person walking around every day being strangled. That was me metaphorically being strangled by anxiety. Every decision I did came from a person that was highly anxious. I used to move mad, and I don't even mean mad in the way that like people would know outwardly, because you don't know. You just think, oh, she does this because that's Roshan. No, I do this because I'm bugging out inside. I'm doing this because my PTSD is high. Like, I'm doing this because, and sometimes I get myself in situations and I laugh and I'm like, I remember for me to be in the same environment, this is what I'd have to do, or this is what I wouldn't have to do. And I just feel so much freer now. You know, I feel so much lighter. And I think a lot of us aren't even aware of how much heavy weight we have on us that comes from emotional baggage. Like, emotional baggage is actually heavy, and I don't think people actually deep it until you get rid of it. Because otherwise, it just feels like this tenseness in your body has always been there. But it's kind of like having a massage. You go into the massage, and the masseuse is like, oh, you've got all these knots over your body. And you're like, I have knots in my ankle. Like, I have knots here. And then when they finish, you're like, I feel so much lighter.
Exactly.
But sometimes they're in the middle of it, they're pressuring.
And it's painful.
And it's hard. And you're like, but at the end, I'm going to feel good.
That's a really good analogy. That's a great analogy. Because even after the massage is over, it takes like a day or two to recover from that deep tissue, right?
Sometimes you get a cold because they've really pushed everything out of you. Then you're fine. You're like, fuck it. I love massages. I'm going to get another one.
Exactly. All right, folks. I think we've drilled the importance of mental health into everyone enough for the day or for this episode. Not to worry, we'll keep talking about it every now and again. It's an important part of what we do.
Is there a certain part of mental health you want us to explore? Let us know. Because I do know a lot of women in our community are on the neurodivergent spectrum. And I do think that's something that, not me, myself or Leanne speaking about directly, but getting people on our platform to talk about it would probably be really beneficial.
100%. And if anyone is interested in coming on and talking about their experience as a neurodiverse person, just reach out to us.
Thank you so much for listening to the Unapologetically Black podcast, brought to you by the Dope Black Women CIC.
If you like this episode, please tweet us, DM us, or even message us at Dope Black Women across all socials.
Unapologetically Black.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.